the conversation between Socrates and Polus goes up to page 70. I guess it starts at the very bottom of page 43 and goes up to 70. Before we hop into this, though, let's sort of recap some of the themes here. One of the central themes of this dialogue, really, is, if you will, philosophy versus power, and power politics. The first word in the Greek is polemos, or war. And the dialogue's dramatic dates are extremely strange, because events that happened in 429 BC and events that happened in 406 BC are mentioned as having just happened. So this basically spans a period of 25 years, all in one conversation. But it is interesting that the years 430 to 404 BC were the years of the Peloponnesian War. The war is evoked in the first word and in the dating of the dialogue, and that's the background of the whole discussion. It's all bounded by the 26 years of the Peloponnesian War. They talk about the city walls and fortifications and military engineering and things like that. They talk about power politics. This was the time of the height and the downfall of Athenian imperialism. So it's an interesting setting to evoke. Gorgias, when he asks what good rhetoric secures, argues or claims that it secures the greatest of human goods. And what's the greatest of human goods? It's power, which for him is interchangeable with freedom. Freedom for oneself and power over others. When we get to Polus, we find that Polus argues that orators, those who are trained in rhetoric, and tyrants have the greatest power, and it's the same kind of power. What does this power allow them to do? It allows them to do things like this. It allows them to exile their enemies or kill them or expropriate their property. And when we get to Callicles, we find that Callicles argues that what is right? Well, might. Might makes right. Justice is the advantage of the stronger, is the position of Callicles. So all of Socrates' interlocutors in this dialogue, Gorgias, Polus, and Callicles, are power politics types to varying degrees. Gorgias believes that power needs to be justly administered, right, or justly governed, but frankly, Polus and Callicles are quite skeptical of that. And one of the things that Socrates is trying to do is he's trying to argue the case of right against the case of might. And this is the war, in a sense, in the dialogue. And it's very appropriate that it's a war between the sophists and him, because the sophists were the advocates of power politics, a kind of ruthless political realism, whereas Socrates is an advocate of a kind of political idealism. So let's actually look in the text, starting at the very beginning of the conversation with Polus. Polus means colt, little horse. And there is something coltish about Polus. There's a certain boyish enthusiasm about him. And the first thing that he does on page 43, when he bursts into the argument and takes it over, is he accuses Socrates of bad taste. Because what Socrates has done is he's, in effect, shamed poor Gorgias into contradicting himself. Gorgias has argued that anybody who comes to him to learn rhetoric, if they don't already know what justice is, will learn what justice is from him. And therefore, anybody who is a rhetorician will use rhetoric justly, because to know the just is to be a just man. That's the assumption. And this contradicts an earlier statement that Gorgias made, which is that rhetoric is simply a morally neutral art, simply a technical skill, and that if a student of rhetoric misuses the skill and does something bad with it, well, that's the student's fault. It's not the rhetorician. Or it's not the teacher's fault. So Gorgias at first absolves himself of any moral responsibility for the use to which the art he teaches is put. But then, later on, he wants to argue that all of his students will necessarily use what they learn justly, because they will be just men, either before or after the educational process has been completed. So there's a contradiction there. And what Polus argues is that Gorgias has contradicted himself simply because he was too ashamed to reject justice. Too ashamed to reject the pressure that Socrates was putting him under to disavow justice. But that's what one needs to do, Polus thinks, in order to defend one's cause, is to disavow justice. Now, whether or not Gorgias was arguing in bad faith, whether or not Gorgias is genuinely and sincerely a person who is concerned with justice, or merely somebody who was trying to seem that way because that's the socially appropriate thing to do, we don't know. But we certainly know that Polus is no gentleman if his immediate assumption is that Gorgias is just, you know, trying to bow to the powers that be, to common opinion, and give mere lip service to justice. That's a very cynical assumption. And gentlemen aren't cynical. Okay, they're idealistic on some level. So we know that Polus is no gentleman. However, from the very beginning, Polus does seem to have some sense of right and wrong. He accuses Socrates of arguing in bad faith, which is a kind of bad taste or bad form, but it's bad, and he's willing to blame him. And one of the things that's interesting about Socrates' conversation with Polus is that Socrates depends upon Polus' willingness to argue that certain things are fine in order to defeat him, ultimately, in the end. And he's constantly using the word fine, which is translated fine or beautiful in various contexts. The Greek is kalon. And the Greek word for gentleman means a fine and good man, or noble and good man. Other translations of kalon are noble. So noble, beautiful, fine, all of these are translations of the same term. And Socrates peppers his conversation with Polus with these terms, and it's an indication that this is being used by Socrates to lead Polus along in the argument. So there is something slightly gentlemanly about Polus. There is something about him that responds to moral distinctions, and what Socrates is trying to do is he's trying to isolate that amidst all of his cynicism and slowly coax him along until he becomes, well, more tractable, more docile, more teachable. And eventually he defeats him in the end. And then Callicles jumps in. And basically what Callicles does is he says he realizes that you have to be even less gentlemanly to make the case for rhetoric. And so he's much more forthright in his amoralism and contempt for justice than Gorgias or Polus. But these guys know what's at stake, and Callicles knows more than the others what's at stake. To defend the cause of the sophists is to attack the cause of justice. To defend power politics is to attack and destroy justice. And anybody who finds that justice has some claim on their souls is going to be an inadequate power politician. Callicles wants to be the pure power politician. And so he's a very forthright enemy of justice. So anyway, let's look into the text, very last line of 43. What says Socrates? Do you two actually hold such an opinion about rhetoric as you are now saying? He's pointed out Gorgias' contradiction. Or do you think, because Gorgias was ashamed not to agree further with you, that the rhetorical man also knows the just, noble, and good things, and if he came to him, not knowing these things, that he himself would teach them, and then from this agreement perhaps some contradiction came about in the speeches, this you are really fond of, when you yourself have led people on to such questions. For who do you think would utterly deny both that he knows the just things and that he would teach others? But it is much rudeness to lead arguments into such things. What he's saying is, look, Socrates, you only win because nobody is going to be willing to deny that they're concerned with justice, even if they're not concerned with it. No one's going to say it. They'll be ashamed of it. And so Socrates is just depending upon this. And that's rude. It's boorish to argue that way. I mean, we're all men of the world here, he's saying. It's like asking, have you ever been drunk? Or have you ever cheated on your wife? No one's going to admit to these things, even if they're true. And it's just bad form to make any argument depend upon being frank about things like this. There's a kind of knowing worldly cynicism here that he's displaying. And what Socrates does is he says, well, most noble polis. You know, he's already getting that word fine in there, kalon, noble. Surely it is on purpose that we acquire companions and sons so that when we ourselves, having become older, are tripped up, you younger ones who are present might set our life upright again, both in deeds and in speeches. You know, it's good to have young colts like you around when old farts like us foul up. You can correct us, Polis. So he draws him into a conversation and he says, look, Polis, I do want you to abide by one condition, and that's that you will have a conversation rather than a speech. I don't want you to filibuster. It is kind of interesting. Why is Socrates so insistent upon not letting these guys speak at length, but having an interchange? Yeah, I mean, he does keep control. He can intervene at every step in the argument to sort of guide it to the conclusions that he wants to lead to. Also, if you let a rhetorician start speaking, what happens is they immediately lapse into a kind of unthinking stream of cliches. They just come out with sound bites, with newspeak, with canned cliches and phrases. And what that does is that inhibits thought, and in fact makes thought impossible, both for the person who's speaking and also for anybody who's listening. What Socrates is really doing by insisting that these high-flown rhetoricians just have a conversation, is he's preventing them from sliding into this cliché-ridden non-think. And he also does allow him to constantly direct the conversation rather than let those guys take control, which is not something you really want them to do. Polis takes up the issue of what kind of art rhetoric is. And he asks Socrates, well, what kind of art do you think it is, Socrates? And Socrates says, I don't think it's an art at all, which is an extraordinary claim. And there's a distinction that's being made in the text between an art, which is, the term is techne, from which we get the word technique and technology, and what he calls experience in this translation. And the Greek word is empiria, from which we get the word experience, empirical, right? Empiria versus techne, or experience versus art. Now, experience isn't a really good translation of this word anymore, because when we think of experience, we think of, oh, I had a lovely experience the other night at dinner. It's something that's subjective, and it just sort of washes through you. Whereas what experience means here is more like having a skill that you learn over time, being seasoned. And a good term for this would be a knack. When you get the knack for something, that means that through practice you've acquired a certain skill or ability. But you don't necessarily have to have a very good understanding of what makes this skill or ability possible. And you don't necessarily have any real means of teaching this to anybody else, except by just recommending that they practice, right? Whereas an art, it requires a certain amount of reflectiveness. There's a certain attempt not only to, well, an art requires not only practice, but it also requires a certain reflective capacity to distill principles from the practices. And then when one teaches, one can teach these principles and guide the student through their apprenticeship, whereas a knack lacks this intellectual quality. A person who has a mere knack of doing things is a bad teacher. They might be a good practitioner, but a bad teacher. Whereas a person who has a genuine art is a good teacher as well as a good practitioner. Also, generally, you find that if a person has a mere knack for doing something based on experience, when they find extraordinary or odd situations, their knack is less useful, it breaks down. Whereas the person with art, because they have a greater distance and a kind of reflectiveness about what their activity is, has a greater ability to deal with strange emergent situations that the pure fumbling, you know, habits of the other person don't really allow them to grapple with. In older English, if you look, say, in the 18th century, the word empiric is a term for a quack or a bumbler, as opposed to a true artisan. So if somebody's accused of being an empiric, it means that they practice something artlessly. And this is the sense in which you could use experience to translate that. A kind of bumbling quack, a person who has a knack but not really an art. And other translations use the word knack to translate empiria, and that's probably a better way of translating it when you get right down to it. Now, the distinction between knacks, if you will, and arts are laid out in a number of terms, and I'll just sort of lay out some of the distinctions here. First of all, empiria always aims at gratification. And what is gratification? Well, it's understood in terms of a kind of sensuous pleasure model. It's hedonistic. Well, how does that differ from art? Well, art is not necessarily always gratifying in the sense that it's sensuously gratifying. For instance, the art of the dentist involves very few sensuous pleasures, aside from the occasional sicko, little shop of horror, aside from the occasional masochist. Very few people take any sensuous pleasure in the ministrations of their dentist. Yet, at the same time, the dentist's art pursues a good. It's just not a gratifying or sensuous good. So the idea is that arts, properly used, again, you can also have the dentist like a marathon man who uses his dentistry skills to torture people. Mm-hmm. But the point is that, properly used, art pursues a good beyond mere pleasure. It's always easier to take children to people who have knacks than arts. It's always easier to take children to the candy store than to the dentist, okay, because one's more immediately gratifying than the other. So that's one distinction. A knack lacks, I'll just use the Greek word logos, it lacks reason, it lacks a rational account of what's going on, whereas art always has logos. And by logos, I just mean a rational account, a kind of reflective moment to it that allows you to step back from your practices, distill out certain principles and patterns, and then teach these. And that brings us to the next issue, not the teachable versus teachable. Now, the non-teachability of a knack is different from the non-teachability of philosophy. Remember that philosophy for Socrates can't be taught either. But that's not because the philosopher doesn't have any reasons or sufficient rational understanding of what philosophy is. Philosophy isn't primarily a practical thing. Philosophy isn't teachable because we already know it, in some sense. Whereas mere knacks are not teachable because the person who's supposed to teach doesn't have the ability to give an abstract account of what's happening, meaning that it lacks logos. You can teach a knack by forcing the person to just go through the motions, right? But it's not, that's a kind of degraded sense of teaching. Maybe you can just say less teachable, if you don't like saying not teachable altogether. He argues that people who have knacks are constantly guessing, trial and error, whereas art is characterized by knowing. The difference between a quack doctor and a person who's really a good doctor is that, you know, the quack is guessing what you've got, and the good doctor knows. I mean, that's the sense. Maybe that distinction doesn't work out quite that way. I mean, you might put it this way. Sometimes a quack is a person who guesses artlessly, whereas a good doctor is a person who's more artful at guessing.
Because there is a kind of conjectural quality that goes on in diagnostic. It's not just knowing. It's knowing through something else, and that involves interpreting signs and conjecturing and things like that. But you can do that more or less artfully. One of the things that Socrates describes Naxos in terms of is, well, the term, it's translated as flattery here. Okay. And the Greek is kolakeia, and in a way it's not a good term because it means more like a panderer. And I think that's better, pandering. Naxos are always pandering, and what are they pandering to? Well, gratification, pleasure. Right? Whereas art isn't a kind of pandering, because it doesn't just gratify. So, what's the opposite of flattery for the Greeks? Well, it's friendship, in this sense, that it actually does you some good. It's a relationship that does you some good, as opposed to just panders to your vices. Friendship might not be the best term, I guess, here, but the idea, it's a relationship that edifies and improves, rather than panders to a person's vices and follies. Naxos, he says, are always involved with deceit, whereas arts are honest. And the question is, well, what does he mean by that? Well, a person who's got merely a knack for something often will go out and pretend that they know things that they really don't. And they're just sort of counting on their ability to fumble through, guess through. Whereas with knowledge comes a greater ability to be honest about one's knowledge, because one has things that one's willing to fess up to, abilities rather than deficits. Socrates says that knacks are connected with folly, whereas in some way art is closer to wisdom. Now, wisdom is an art, but it's much more closely related to art than is a knack. And something that panders is right, something that panders to people's worst instincts or worst characteristics. And for Socrates, one of the worst things you can possibly be is a fool. He also says, look, knacks are unfree. You've got real and phantom versions of everything. Right? And the idea is if something is an art, it's got a greater worth to it than its phantom version, which is merely a knack. And what I'll do is I'll put on the board a kind of chart that differentiates between these things. Art is more, if you will, liberal or free. In what sense? It's freer from experience, freer from getting your hands dirty. Even the arts that are manual arts are still less involved with constantly mucking around, trial and error, that kind of stuff, right, than a person who has merely a knack and is always dependent upon trial and error. And for the Greeks, freedom always involves being free from gross labor, from getting your hands dirty. And because it's more free, an art is more noble, whereas knacks are base or ignoble. And he actually uses the term, he also talks about how, well, he uses the term evil to describe knacks, and he says that arts are good. You know, he's piling on a lot of terms to differentiate them. Another term that he uses, and I'm sorry that board is such an absolute mess, he argues that, or claims that knacks are possessed by courageous guessers. And by courageous, I think he means something brash. People who are willing to take risks, in this case. People who are willing to guess. Take risks. That's how you do trial and error. Whereas more cautious people don't have knacks. More cautious people would want an art, where they have a sense of, because it's got a greater rational component, it allows you to see further ahead rather than charge blindly ahead. And he also talks about how the people who have knacks are just more social. They're the kinds of people who, because they don't have a real art, are the ones you would expect would depend more upon social interactions. They're the kinds of people who know how to, smoothies, car salesmen.
Smooths.
The schmoozers, yeah, exactly. Because they depend more upon other people's opinions of their abilities than their actual abilities, right? So they have to be schmoozers. Whereas the artist can be less social because they depend more upon their actual abilities. And there's a lot of truth to that. And so the picture of the person with the knack is extremely negative. They're panderers. They can't really explain what they do. They can't really teach well. They're constantly guessing. They're deceitful. They play upon people's follies. They're unfree in their activities. Their activities constantly get them down in the mud, hair, and dirt of existence. They're base. They're evil. They're courageous in the sense that they're brash. I think brashness might be a better word here. They have a kind of brashness and boldness, and they're very social, and they're schmoozer types. They depend upon deluding people and getting along with people. Here's this this line that I love. I was forced to think about recently, looking at the panoply of political candidates that are jockeying for position. There's a certain type of man whose place in the world depends upon keeping their words evasive and their clothes impeccable. That really describes a lot of the sort of empty suits in politics today. They keep themselves evasive and unclear. They don't make any commitments, but they always look really neat and well-groomed. These are the people with the knack. I'm going to put a big chart on the board that lays out an extremely complex and I think really profound analogy that Socrates lays out in his conversation with Polus. So let's put this up on the board and we can talk about it. The soul and the body and their relationship and difference and the analogies, the likenesses you can draw between the care of the two, become absolutely central for understanding what Socrates is going to lay out as the difference between the true political art and rhetoric and sophistry. And Socrates presents himself in this dialogue not as a philosopher, but as the true practitioner of politics, the political art. Okay. So let's see how this works out. First of all, let's put the body and the soul on the board. And we're talking specifically about care of the body and care of the soul. When you take care of the body, you can do a number of things. You can impart real health to the body, and the art that imparts real health to the body, that makes the body healthy, is what? Does anyone?
Gymnastic.
Yeah, gymnastic. Now that literally means running around nude, but gymnasium was a place where people walked around nude, but it refers to the art of physical fitness, right? Now in caring for the body, you can also remove real sickness. And what is the art that removes the real sicknesses of the body? Right. However, you can have phony versions of gymnastic and medicine. And the phony version of gymnastic imparts the appearance of health. And phony medicine removes the appearance of illness or sickness. And what imparts the appearance of health is, this is kind of odd, isn't it? Well, it's cookery.
Well, the appearance of health.
Yeah, and what removes the appearance of sickness is cosmetics. Okay, now let's talk about these things. It's fairly clear that what he means by gymnastic would be all the things that make us healthy and fit. That would include all the forms of exercise and watching your diet and things like that. And this is not medicine because it's not repairing sickness, it's preventing it. And of course, medicine removes real sickness. It's so well and good. The next thing here is to deal with the soul. Okay. Now, what imparts real health to the soul? Well, he says something very strange. Legislation.
And what removes real sickness from the soul? Justice. What imparts the appearance of health? Well, again, I thought it was rhetoric. And what removes the appearance of sickness is sophistry. Although, the distinction between the two is a little bit fishy. Now, how does legislation, first of all, impart health to the soul? How does legislation make our souls good? How does politics make your soul better? Isn't this a strange notion? What he's saying here is that statecraft is soulcraft. But how does legislation do that? Yeah, I mean, Socrates always is working with this very strict analogy between the city and the soul that's central to the republic, and here it's central too. The proper order of the city is the guide to the proper order of the soul for, in the republic. And as it turns out, it's very clear that the city, the proper city, is an ideal thing. It's not going to be real, but you can still make yourself a citizen of it by taking care of your own soul. But it's very clear that, first of all, forward legislation, a legislature is a nomothetes, is the term, and someone who lays down laws, okay? But nomos for the Greeks was a broader concept than just laws in the sense of statutes. It has to do with all of the conventions, the mores, if you will, of society, any kind of normative convention. And the fact is that the character of human beings is radically affected by the kind of conventions that they live under. And it's very interesting to observe this by observing people who grew up under different laws. There's such thing as a national character, or the characters of different peoples. And you find that when people move from one society to another, they will feel somewhat out of place, right? Because people just aren't as easily intelligible to them, okay? Because they grow up under different conventions. And also that they have different characteristics, and sometimes people are just annoying. The British, well, especially the French, people who go to France, Americans who go to France, oftentimes find the French annoying, and they find us annoying too. Just because there are different conventions and different values that grow up. This is why there's such a wealth of anti-French jokes out there. And I'm sure the French have a wealth of ugly American jokes, too. Culture, conventions, laws impart character. They impart certain characters to the people who grow up under them. And because of this, if you can grant that culture shapes our characters, then you have to grant that it can shape our characters for the better or the worse. And the assumption that legislation can impart real health to the soul is based on this idea that culture affects our characters and can affect it, therefore, for the better. Proper legislation creates conventions that cultivate and ennoble and improve the soul. Bad politics does just the opposite. Now, what removes real sickness from the soul? Justice. And for him, that means, in this context, punishment. Virtue is the health of the soul, according to Socrates. Justice is the health of the soul. Injustice, vice, crime, these are signs of sickness in the soul. What happens when your body is sick? You go to the doctor. What happens when your soul is sick? You go to the judge. And you get punished. You find somebody who's going to judge the peculiar sickness that exists in your soul and prescribe certain purgatives to get it out of you and make you better. The rewards would be more the legislation, right? Those would be encouraging you to do good things. Whereas punishment discourages you to do bad things, but also removes bad things from you. In the context of the text, if you had read it, you'd see that he's really very much concerned with punishment. It's a system of penology, okay? The discipline would go under legislation, the punishment would go under justice in this scheme of things. The reward is the health of the soul. Both of these have rewards, right? The reward of justice for Socrates is that you're cured. We will deal with this issue of punishment later. But Socrates has a purely rehabilitative conception of punishment. It is a kind of medical treatment for the soul to take away real sicknesses from the soul and make the person better and whole.
Now, it goes without saying that virtually none of the punishments that we contrive in our society have anything to do with the real rehabilitation of a person's soul. And if people get thrown into maximum security prisons and do happen to come out of there better human beings, it's probably less because of the conventions that we have set in place in the justice system and more an act of God. And even that's questionable. I mean, oftentimes the acts of God are just phony. Now we need to talk about the phony version of the care of the soul. What imparts the appearance of health of the soul? Sophistry. Okay, now what does that mean? Well, think about the role of ethos or character in rhetoric. Aristotle talks about the role of character in rhetoric and how if you're going to be a persuasive speaker, you have to have a persuasive, respectable persona. You might be a real SOB, but if you're trying to persuade people, you have to present the persona of an earnest, decent, good person, somebody who cares, right? Somebody who feels for you, or whatever the currency of concern is in a society. Today, it's all feeling. You know, in other societies, it would be nobility. Exactly. You know, we're concerned with people who sympathize. Whereas, you know, 200 years ago, the persona would be somebody who's heroic or self-sacrificing or, you know, self-controlled. I mean, different cultural eras have different ideas of what the ideal person is, but no matter what culture you're going to be in, if you're going to be persuasive, you have to radiate the persona of the person that people want to listen to and believe and follow.
That's very feminine. Instead of more masculine as a hero, that's more on the male.
But we have a more feminized political culture today.
That's great.
There's no question about that, whether you think it's great or not. There's no question that the language of political discourse is more of the language
heroes,
of feeling.
It's
interesting how it can progress. Yeah. Sophistry has everything to do with the presentation of the health of the soul, which is virtue. The capacity to take on the persona of a virtuous person. It's about acting, right? The sophists teach you how to act. Socrates argues that all these phony things are knacks. These are knacks down here, the phony bad stuff, and these are arts. Now, what is removing the appearance of sickness from the soul? Well, the clearest example of that or analogy to that today would be the art of the spin doctor. You know, you have guys who have the capacity to put a good light on anything. And these people are absolutely crucial in politics today. They manipulate appearances. You're caught doing something bad. By the time these people are finished with you, people want to pin the Congressional Medal of Honor on you. Or think that you're a victim rather than a villain. Yeah, that's the general way of spin doctoring things, right? Who are Ted Bundy?
Child.
Abuse as a child. too many Twinkies. Too many Twinkies. The Twinkie defense. Watch too much pro wrestling. It's our fault. We're all guilty. Rhetoric is, you know, the term that's used for this. You could switch them around because they're all sort of one and the same in this context. The sophists are the teachers of rhetoric. But rhetoric is what removes the appearance of sickness. It doctors appearances, right? It's the cookery of the soul, if you will. To impart the appearance of health is to remove the appearance of sickness, right? And vice versa. To impart the appearance of health, which is what the sophist does, it's the same thing as removing the sickness. It just depends on the initial status, right, of the person. But they really involve the same sorts of things, and it's all the kind of knack, he argues, which is base, ignoble, evil, for fakery.
Sure.
This is the false care of the body, cosmetics and cookery. It's the junk food of appearance industry, right? And the false care of the soul is sophistry and rhetoric, which is false politics, for Socrates.
Whereas the true care of the soul is what he calls true politics, and he claims that what he is the only true politician. Okay, in Athens. He's concerned with imparting real health and removing real sickness, and he thinks that proper legislation is what imparts real health, and proper justice is what removes real sickness. And all of this is in the order of reality, if you will. The arts are dealing with reality, what's real. Whereas the knacks deal with appearance, what's not real. That's another important distinction between the two kinds of things. Now, this is a very complex and wonderful analogy, right? Sophistry is the cosmetics of the soul. Rhetoric is the cookery of the soul. Justice is the medicine of the soul. Legislation is the gymnastic of the soul. Legislation is the gymnastic as justice is the medicine. Socrates makes it very clear that he thinks that understanding these kinds of proportions or analogies is it's a kind of mathematical understanding, he claims, and that Callicles' great failure, he says, is that he doesn't know geometry. He doesn't know proportionality, and therefore he can't know justice. He doesn't know the proportions that bind together the cosmos out of a chaos, he says. And these are the analogies, if you will, the proportions that bind together the care of the soul in the realm and the body in the realm of reality and the phony, spurious knack for caring for body and soul in the realm of appearance, which is the realm of society, the cave, the world as it really exists, the world at war that they're living in.